Now, you know, most of us will never go beyond 35 or 40,000 feet, although some have been to those lofty heights and beyond. Steve Fawcett and Einar Enevoldsson set a record for flying to an altitude of 52,720 feet in a glider. Imagine that. Now, this amazing feat took place last August in the skies over Argentina. Joining us next on the stage here at Theater in the Woods, Steve Fawcett and Einar Enevoldsson to talk about their project, the Perlin Project.
Well, after Jim explained that he set his altitude record flying around the moon, I feel a bit like a piker to talk about, you know, flying to 50,000 feet. But it was a major project for us. We aspired to do this. We took this on over a long period of time. It's been going on. It went on for about 6 years on the project. We had to develop the glider. We wanted not only to fly a glider to the absolute altitude record, but we also wanted to fly a glider beyond the troposphere and into the stratosphere. And we wanted to fly a glider into the polar vortex. And ultimately, we finally did succeed, making our flight in August 29th last year. Our project is called the Perlin Project. And if you look at these clouds on the screen, they're nacreous clouds. They're at extreme altitude, often found in the polar areas. And we call it the Perlin Project because Perlin means pearl in Icelandic. Einar came up with this, and these are pearl-colored clouds, and we're trying to get to those clouds. Before our project, in fact, since 1947, the glider altitude records have been held here. This is Mount Whitney in the Sierra Nevada of California. So either over or near Mount Whitney is where all the altitude record was raised until we set out to do a different plan. Now, you're probably familiar with, or you probably automatically think of in gliders, flying in thermals. You get into the thermals and you circle and you know, climb up this rising column of hot air. Well, that's not what we do. We fly in mountain wave for a purpose of altitude. And this is what it looks like. This is a lenticular cloud. And you will find rising air that rises up on the windward side, that is the wind side of this cloud, and we'll fly up, not in the cloud, but beside the cloud. And that wave actually continues above the cloud. These waves are, mountain wave is created by high-speed winds, often jet stream, hitting a mountain range and setting up the cycle of wave. And not only just one wave, but there's downstream waves as well. And the science of this, Einar Enevoldsson became highly interested in this. Einar was his career was as a NASA test pilot, but he also did some flying in high altitude aircraft, and currently, in fact, holds the altitude record for turboprop airplanes at 54,000 feet, and the unofficial record, he once flew another turboprop airplane to 61,000 feet. But he's been the expert at this, a lifelong glider pilot, and was the originator of this effort to fly a glider into the stratosphere.
Sure.
Look at the picture here. This is the origin of the project, and it was a German scientist had succeeded in taking this picture over the central plateau of northern Scandinavia, right about the Arctic Circle. And what it shows is the trajectory of air particles up at 23 kilometers top, and He flew along underneath this thing and shot a pulsed laser up and then recorded the backscatter. And from that, you can deduce the temperature. And the yellow stuff is nitric acid trihydrate, and the red stuff is water ice. And it's interesting to a lot of people because this cloud eats ozone. It's a complex chemical process. It starts with the solution of nitric acid in water, and eventually eats ozone and processes a lot of the polar ozone during the winter. Okay. So, NASA's been interested in this, and here's some a picture of a traverse made by a NASA DC-8 in January 25, 2000. And they have a magic instrument which looks above and below the airplane, about 20,000 feet. And maybe if I can find the mouse here. I don't think I can find it.
I can't find it either.
Okay.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
He starts from your left and goes to the right. Excuse me, he starts from the right and goes to the left. And the first big set of ripples is the primary wave right over the highest mountain, Mount Sarek, which is about 7,000 feet high in Scandinavia. And at lower altitude below the DC-8, you can see extreme amplitude of motion of 4,000 or 5,000 feet. The air is going up and down. And then up along about 40,000 feet, halfway up there where the DC-8 is, it's only moving up and down a few hundred feet. And then above it, the amplitude progressively increases until you go off the top of the ability of the instrument to read, and it's moving 2,000 or 3,000 feet again. And that's in accordance with the general theory of waves. And probably by 100,000 feet, this is twice as high. The wave amplitude is twice as high, unless at some point it became unstable and the meteorologists say the wave broke and it degenerates into a massive turbulence field.
Thanks.
So the question is, for a wave to propagate vertically, the wind has to increase continuously as you go higher. And where does the wind come from? Because this wave goes up to 100,000 feet. And the answer is, it comes from the polar vortex. And where does the polar vortex come from? Here we're depicting the south end of the Earth in the winter. So the winter end of the Earth goes into shadow, the stratosphere chills, and it just collapses like an accordion. And as it comes down, the Coriolis effect accelerates it into a vortex, and it circles around the Earth, and it has a peak velocity at around 100,000 feet. And it's on the order of 200 to 250 miles an hour at that altitude. And in the northern hemisphere, it runs at latitudes on the order of 60 to 80 degrees. And in the southern hemisphere, it runs from about 45 to 80 degrees. So we thought about this a while and decided that since this happens in the winter, as soon as the end of the Earth starts coming out of the shadow, well, the air stops descending, and within a couple of days, this whole wind field just stops until the next winter. So we have to do our thing in the winter near the pole. So since in the southern hemisphere, you don't have to go as close to the pole, you have a lot more daylight, and it's not as cold, and it's a lot more attractive. I'll just go over this quickly. Along horizontally is altitude up to 30 kilometers, you see, over on the right side. And the vertical axis is the motion of a balloon. And this balloon is launched from the middle of South Island, New Zealand, by a research organization studying mainly UV and the effect of the ozone hole on ultraviolet. And what it shows is, in accordance with the theory, that the wave amplitude gets very large at very high altitude. It shows up here at 30 kilometers, which is about 100,000 feet, but we have vertical velocity of the air is about 25 feet a second. And if you compute the sinking speed of a sailplane at 100,000 feet, it's maybe 20 feet a second. So it means that you can keep climbing until you reach the basically until you reach the coffin corner of the sailplain. And we've, with a design analysis, you can show that coffin corner for a sailplain is of the order of 110,000 feet. So 100,000 feet is a reasonable goal to actually fly a sailplane. So,
That's not me.
It's not me. So Zeev suggested that to learn our business and to get our feet wet, find out if we could really do this, we should take a production glider and modify it extensively and see if we could borrow pressure suits from NASA. And NASA certainly jumped at the chance, and they provided the pressure suit until the NASA pressure suits went out of date, and then upon request from NASA, the Air Force provided pressure suits. And so we got on with the job of taking the airplane apart and putting it back together with extensive modifications. It was a motor glider, so we took out the motor and the prop and all the associated equipment. This is a back cockpit. It shows a lot of electrical system and a lot of heated instruments, because we have no heat in the airplane except battery supplied. So we applied heat to some of the instruments to keep from freezing up. Next slide. And back in the engine bay, we put in two 10-liter liquid oxygen converters, and then the heat exchanger, so you make sure the oxygen is gaseous when you breathe it. And as soon as you go to pressure suits, they're very extravagant in their use of oxygen, so that's why we use the liquid oxygen. And at that point, you you start getting into some logistics. These liquid oxygen containers, we truck down 96 hours by truck from Buenos Aires after having located a source of aviators breathing oxygen in liquid form in Buenos Aires. And then they boil off in a couple of weeks, so you gotta get some more. And pressure suits take an enormous amount of continuous care and feeding. And you change seals, do inspections, do tech order updates. So it's just a year-round job to keep the pressure suit in running order. And we were lucky to get a retired Lockheed pressure suit tech to do the job for us. So we started our wave soaring in the Sierras. We take off from California City. And on days with good waves, sometime it's a little windy on the ground. Here it's about 55 knots. Next. And then sometimes we went to New Zealand. We chose New Zealand because of its, for one thing, we had the data from the scientific balloons that were launched, and our site was quite near that. And then there's tremendous expertise in New Zealand. The Kiwis have been flying up and down the South Island for many years, and they could show us the ropes on getting started. And this is a picture of South Island, New Zealand from space, and it shows the white stuff is the Southern Alps, which go up to about 12,000 feet. And we were just downwind of Mount Cook, the highest point there, and that's where we did most of our flying. You want to?
Yeah. So this is more of a typical mountain wave, which we may have experienced in New Zealand. We got some good flights in, but we actually never got above 30,000 feet, even though we went down there for three seasons. It just didn't shape up quite right for us as far as the wind patterns coming straight across the Southern Alps. And so finally we had, we had some beautiful flying. Here's the glider, and it's flying over the snowfields in South Island, New Zealand. So we decided to move the project to Argentina because we could get farther south. So instead of 45 degrees south, we could get it 50 degrees south, and which is really way down there in the southern tip of South America. And we're in the in Patagonia. These are the guanacos, which are roaming around. And we brought our kit there. There's our 40-foot container, unloading it at the El Calafate Airport in Patagonia. This is the airport terminal. The Argentine Air Force, which controls the airspace and airports in Argentina, thought this was a great idea to be pursuing this scientific project and the altitude record, and they gave us every cooperation imaginable in Argentina. So if we say, well, we'd like to park our airplane next to the airliners at the main terminal because the wind protection's better there, they say, oh, no problem. So, and this is what we were looking out over from El Calafate across a lake, Lago Argentina. And this is the mountain wave as we were looking at it on one of our flight days in Argentina. Finally, on our second season in Argentina, we got down there, and right away there was a good forecast. This is an image, a representation of the mountain wave on the day we did the record. This is the polar vortex circulating around Antarctica. And you can see that it does go and touch against the Patagonia region of Argentina. There's a lot of meteorologists who are very interested in our project. One of them is the Naval Research Laboratory in Monterey. They're doing research on mountain wave, and not only for the Navy, but more importantly for Air Force, and because there's a lot to be learned on this. I think that probably the Air Force has lost some UAVs to the turbulence of mountain wave. They want to understand more about it. And this is so the Naval Research Laboratory modeled the actual terrain we would be flying in and was able to forecast. This is a 36-hour in advance forecast, and the yellow area you see on the left is the primary wave. So the wind is coming from the left on this screen, and the altitudes here go up to 20,000 meters or 66,000 feet from behind this mountain. And you will see not only this primary wave, but if you look to the right more, you'll see another wave that seems to be going higher. That's the secondary wave, and you see another wave which looks like it's going higher than that, the tertiary wave, and some other smaller waves farther downwind. So we had some really good meteorological research. And this one, you can hardly see, but we had just come off of tow, and our tow plane, we towed to 13,000 feet, got off tow, and started on our climb, climbing up that primary wave. Then we tried going upwind to see whether we could find a stronger wave up there, and then we tried going north and south, and we were just kind of stuck there at 33,000 feet. It seemed to be our top. Then we went downwind and actually ended up over, this is Torres del Paine National Park in Chile, a very, very dramatic place. And we found the secondary wave right over the top of Torres del Paine National Park. And that's where we were able to continue our climb. And when we got up very high, it was actually very, very difficult to stay with the wave. So we had some tracking GPSs on our screen, and the wave was less than a mile long, or the one we were following up, and we'd go back and forth, and we'd try to keep right on this wave until we got up nearly to 51,000 feet. And at that time, it was pretty cold up there. Poor Einar. I had a lot of padding under. I was sitting partially on my parachute. Had lots of nice padding. Einar didn't have as much room in his part of the cockpit, and was sitting on the bare fiberglass, and it was getting really cold. So we thought that might be as high as we were going that day, and we started heading home. And here we are. We pull out the spoilers, the orange things you see there, and we're feeling a great deal of success, starting to come down. Then we ran into that tertiary wave, and started to get a climb again. And I suppose if we'd felt we'd had the time, and if it wasn't, if we hadn't, had some problems with the cold, we might have gone higher on that day. But we were nevertheless very delighted. Came back to the El Calafate airport. And landed, and to a great celebration of a successful project. Our meteorologist did model the day that we actually made this flight, as so we could see the pattern of the polar vortex. And this representation, of course, there's sea level at the bottom. It's 100,000 feet altitude at the top of this chart. And on the left is the South Pole. On the right is the right edge is the equator. The small area to the right side there, that's a subtropical jet stream. That's kind of what it looks like. This is some fast air moving through. But in the main area where we climbed up to, you'll see that we're up there at a little over 50,000 feet. And we were actually climbing into the polar vortex. So we were very pleased that we were able to get into this pattern. And in addition, we're interested in the getting into the stratosphere. So we were carrying our NASA instrument pack so we could see how we were doing, so there would be a report of how we were doing relative to the getting into the stratosphere. And you will see from the temperature scale is on the bottom. And so as we climbed up this graph, it got colder and colder, and then the altitude's on the right. So at about 33,000 feet, the temperature stopped getting any colder. We were in the tropopause at that point. Then as we climbed into the stratosphere above 33,000 feet, the temperature actually starts rising again. And this is an indication that we were in the stratosphere. And often the tropopause is very high on the previous flights in the Sierra Nevada or altitude. They may have had a very high tropopause. In our case, we had a low tropopause, and we had the experience of getting clearly into the stratosphere. So it was a long and hard project, and we were delighted that we achieved all three of our objectives: the absolute altitude record in gliders, flying into the stratosphere, and collecting the research on the polar vortex. I think we have some time for some questions, and there's some spotters out there. I can't see because of the lights. But oh, now I can see. Speed and I'm sorry. Pardon? Oh, 2 weeks ago, I'm highly interested in gliders. It goes back a long way. Actually, interestingly, I met a person tonight who is my glider instructor. I learned to fly gliders in West Bend, Wisconsin. And I think he'd forgotten my name, but he was looking at his logbook today and saw Steve Fawcett, and that he'd signed me off in 1973 to fly gliders 24 years ago. And Fred Flood is here tonight, my old glider instructor. And I think it's the most elegant form of flying, and I hope other people will consider it. I got very active in it a few years ago, and now I'm interested in, the entire range of aeronautical records. I'd like to fly faster, farther, and higher. So this was our higher objective. And I also have a program to fly speed records and distance records. And so I've done a total of 12 of the 21 unlimited records in gliders over the past 5 years. One of them was just 2 weeks ago. And we flew the speed record for 1,250 kilometers. And we did that in Nevada. And that was after over a period of 4 years. We made 27 attempts before we finally pulled it off 2 weeks ago.
To your right. Sounds like a very interesting project. I have dozens of questions, but I'll only ask two right now. Talk to me a little bit about the turbulence. Lenticulars are often extremely turbulent, And then the second question is, when are you going to go for the 100,000 feet?
Go for it.
Steve can tell you when we'll go for 100,000. And I will tell you that lenticulars themselves are just almost unnaturally smooth. The air in and around lenticulars is typically extremely smooth. It just seems eerie almost. There's a couple of places where turbulence can occur. One is underneath the lenticulars if you get in the rotor zone, which would be, say, directly under lenticulars. And of course, that can be extremely turbulent. There's cases where the B-52 lost its vertical tail. 747 in Anchorage lost an engine on takeoff, or not long after takeoff. When I say lost the engine, I mean it fell off. and then there's other cases at extreme altitudes. There was an analysis of the all the data we brought back from our record flight, and it showed computed very likely very large turbulence about 2,000 feet above us and about one wavelength about 9 miles downwind from us. So there's a couple of places where turbulence can be very large. But the clouds themselves are not it.
To your left.
I believe you took off from Mendoza, Argentina in a balloon and you tried to go around the world. I don't think you finished, but you went around the world anyway another time. Is that correct?
Yes, my first, my second round the world attempt was made from Mendoza, Argentina. And this is where I met a lot of my team, which I would eventually use in the glider project. That flight in 1998 failed, and I went down in the Coral Sea in a thunderstorm off of Australia. So that didn't work out very well. But so somebody else beat me to making the first round the world balloon flight. The team of Bertrand Picard and Brian Jones, but I still aspired to make the first solo flight around the world by balloon. So I continued after that and did that in 2002.
Your next question is here to the front.
What about studying a flight between Western Africa to, let's say, Brazil with a sailplane riding cumulonimbuses or wave? I guess you're thinking about that, or you should.
At high altitude, I'm not really interested in flying sailplanes in cumulonimbi. And typically, the wind is the wrong direction to go from Western Africa to Brazil. But conceivably, from Brazil to Western Africa in a subtropical jet from the Andes, go to the far west over Peru and cross Brazil. And, it's sort of science fiction, but one might imagine a resonant set of waves that you could fly quite a long way. I don't know if you could make Africa or not.
To your left.
Okay. Thank you. I was going to ask when you were going to go for higher, but someone's already asked that question. My second question was, can Einar remember when he had to take his boots off to fly his first plastic airplane? That was at Moonrakers.
Oh!
Yes, I do. I probably should recognize the voice, but yes, in a lovely British Gliding Club, and I'm sort of built the wrong shape, and I always have trouble fitting into gliders, and frequently I have to take my boots off or shave my head down a little or something to fit in. But I'll have to come and see me.
Your next question is down in the middle.
Yes, Einar, do you have a instrumentation to follow these secondary and tertiary waves, or are you just relying on your experience?
Strictly experience. We don't have anything to measure motion, air motion at a distance. So it'd be based on experience and just go there and try it and see.
Center.
I got two for you. What type of glider did you guys modify? And after you modified it, what was your glide ratio?
It was a DG. It's a good high-performance German glider. And it was a motor glider, as Einar explained, so that the real motivation of having a motor glider is so we would have the space to take the motor out and have a place to put our liquid oxygen and our batteries and scientific packs. The glider was a 50-to-1 glide ratio before we started hanging a lot of scientific instruments on it, and it was probably about a 40-to-1 glide ratio with all the drag we had to conduct our scientific research.
Next question is down in front.
How long were you in the glider when you broke the record? How long of a trip was that?
This was a 4.5-hour flight. The first 45 minutes was the tow up to 13,000 feet. And then, it was pretty fast. On many of our other attempts, we spent over 6 hours just trying to make an unsuccessful attempt. But when you get it right, when you get the right weather pattern, it goes quite quickly.
Center back.
Yeah, I was going to say the first up to about 32,000, we averaged 1,600 feet a minute climb after we left the tow.
Next question's in the middle.
You used a 505 glider for the current record. Are you going to have to do anything special for going up above 50,000 feet and playing in corner of the coffin corner?
We think with a production glider we can get at least 65, maybe a little higher. The aerodynamics of low altitude gliders, the Reynolds number gets them around 65, and the sink speed is going to go up. So you need a special purpose wing to go higher than that.
Center back.
The outside air temperature chart, along with the altitude that you showed in your presentation, it indicates that you had approximately a 60 to 70 degree change in temperature during the flight. When you were recovering the glider, did you take any special precautions to come down slowly to allow the glider to warm up to prevent any damage to the aircraft structure?
This is a common problem with gliders when they get cold. And then, for example, flying in altitude, and then you come down fast and they get warm quickly, it'll crack the paint, especially if it's standard gel coat paint. So you end up with just a spider web, a crazed paint job. We weren't afraid, though. It's a carbon structure. We weren't worried about the overall structure of the glider. So we weren't about to hang around at altitude. We were ready to come down and get on the ground.
Next question's here in the front.
Can you talk about the wind profile? On your way up, I didn't notice you had a graph for that.
A wing profile?
Wind
profile.
Just a change in wind as you climbed up. Do you know what your
let's go back up a little bit.
Do you know what your winds, upper level winds were?
Yeah, this is from the global model, and it agrees pretty well with what we saw. You can see that we had a peak at maybe about 30,000 on the order of, I think it was around 100 knots. And then we did get a slight drop off, maybe 90-ish, 95 knots. And then it started to pick up again around 50. And then as you can see above 50, well, it just increases continuously up to 100. But it wasn't a perfect wind profile. If we'd been 2 or 3 degrees further south, or if the polar vortex had come north 2 or 3 degrees of latitude, we could have probably had a little better ride.
I would add that this is actually a worry that you can get in such strong winds that you'll be facing forward and moving backwards. And the continent of South America is very narrow at that point, and we could find ourselves out in the Atlantic Ocean because we couldn't fly fast enough. So actually, in addition to our pressure suits, we had flotation equipment, so didn't want to use that, but it is always a risk that you might land in the water.
Way in the back.
Yes, this is a little off the subject, and it's for Steve. I was told that you were going to make an attempt on the absolute land sailor speed record. Is that a real project?
Yes, it is. It's so I'm a new project to go after the land speed record. I have bought the current car of Craig Breedlove, and which he had taken up to 675 miles an hour, and then it goes out of control. Our task is to figure out the aerodynamics of the car and go after the speed record, which is currently 763 miles an hour. It's interesting that you would bring it up because it used to be that the land speed record was really something for drag racers. But now the land speed record is up at the speed of sound. And it's no longer so much a car project as it is an aviation project. So my team is built around, my project manager is an aeronautical engineer. For team members, I decided to move the project to Reno, Nevada, so that I could tap in to the Reno air race scene and get the people who work on unlimited air racers. So my entire team does consist of aviation people as we take this on. I'll make the first testing, hopefully in just a month from now, on Bonneville Salt Flats. And I would anticipate that I'll maybe making a record attempt trying to go 800 miles an hour next year.
We have time for one last question.
Here in front of you.
Mr. Fawcett, do you intend to make a museum to archive your accomplishments?
Well, it's... yes, I want people to see what we've done. I mean, I would do these things even if there was no recognition. But I think it's important that we try to communicate, not only to other aviators, but to youth, to get them interested in doing something, whether it's in aviation or anything else, just so that people see how interesting these things are, so that they go out and try to do something in their own lifetime, something that interests them, not the same things that I'm doing, but do something that is interesting to them. So I do seek to get my the things that I've been involved in into museums. My balloon capsule and my Global Flyer are on the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum at this time. Thank you for your interest.